So some of you guys know me, some of you don't. So just before I asked Barb if I could say whatever I wanted to. So I got to Narcotics Anonymous this time 37 years ago. So, you know, I didn't go to the first convention, right? But I got here at convention time, and I can't remember if it was June or July, because one year they had the convention at a different date, but I remember going to Oliver Hall, and everybody had T-shirts on, and I was like, what did I join? Wearing the same friggin' T-shirts? Like, wow. So my recollection of Barb wasn't that I went up to her and asked her for help back then. So the first time I kind of remember Barb is we had meetings at the Stan Daniels Center across the road. So not right in Stan Daniels, it was like where the parole board is now. I think it was the Ramblers group, right? Well, I went to a men's meeting there, but I'll tell you about that in a minute. But Barb used to go to her psychologist before she went to the meeting. So she always had lots to share, right? And when she walked in the room, I used to go, here comes Mrs. N.A. I didn't want to be there, like most people in your new, right? I didn't want to be there. I used to have to, like, put my feet around the bottom of the chair so I'd stay for the whole meeting, and I never stayed afterwards, and I didn't go for coffee. And then I started joining people for coffee, and so through the years I got to know Barb before she left to Vancouver. And one of the things I will say that I'm proud of in Barb's story is, well, first of all, she was a stripper when she got here, so that's some of the guys know more vivid tales about that, but not me. And they can tell you them. Neil knows a couple. But, well, because she did this 12-step call, someone had to go 12-step bar, but that's all, I don't know. But anyways, going back to my story. where was I? If we're already forgetting about it. Okay, so she sold jewelry in the mall, right? So she used to come to meetings and say, they gave me the keys. These friggin' idiots. They gave me the keys to the front door of the jewelry store. Don't they know who I am? You know? And she started learning more about her roots, and I won't say who her uncle was. That's up to her to say from Cold Lake. But Barb is Métis. And she went back to school, and she spent 10 years going to university, become a doctor. So Barb is Dr. Barbara. And the one thing that I think that I will say is that I don't know how to kind of talk about it sometimes, especially if I look at Glenn, I can get it out, because last night I was telling him about being here 37 years, and he goes, it doesn't matter how long you were here. And I go, just shut up and listen to the story. And then I had to go home and make amends for that. But anyways, so we asked Barb to come and speak for our convention. And I think she's been a speaker two or three times. She only remembers one. That's what happens when you get past 70, right? You start forgetting things. But the thing that I know about Barb is that out of all the women that I can say that's still around, it's Charm. It is you, Charm. And I connected with her through COVID because I went on these 24/7 meetings. And here's Barb doing service, right? She's chairing these meetings. So I sent her a message, says, can I call you? And she said, sure, but just text. She didn't want me calling, I guess, just text. So at that time, I didn't quite ask her to be my sponsor, but I had a couple things happen. My dad died the same month, at the end of the month. I had a fire in my place. And Barb was helping me through all this. Like, we're on the phone talking through all that. And then there was an area meeting. And I got to tell Joey this when he gets back from where he is at. But anyways, Joey had a grievance about our area. something to do with the literature or something like that. But I thought, you know, why don't you ask this woman to sponsor you? The worst thing she can tell you is no, right? Like, so Barb became my sponsor. And because she's like super educated, though, a lot of times I thought I was in therapy, just saying. But I'm so happy that she's here tonight and getting to tell her story. And Gary's telling me to wrap it up. He tells me that at every convention meeting. But I will end with, if you haven't talked to Barb and you're a woman here new to recovery, midway through, go introduce yourself to Charm. She has a lot to offer people because, like, just like me, you know, I say this to a few people. Someone said, I sewed this ribbon skirt, and someone told me to twirl in a ribbon skirt. And Miranda, I says, Miranda, you don't twirl in ribbon skirts. She goes, no, they're too tight, right? You'd probably fall down trying to twirl in this thing. But I'm really happy that Barb's here tonight. She came a long way. She drove down here, and she's got lots that she can share with us. So everybody, welcome. I said Barb, but Charm to the mic. Thanks. And I love you, Barb. Good evening, everybody. Hi. I'm Charm. I'm an addict. Welcome to the 40th convention of the Edmonton Area of Narcotics Anonymous. Woohoo! I can't tell you how amazing it is for me to be here in my 40th year clean, in the area where I got clean. It's really awesome. And I just want to say a couple things before I start. There's a whole bunch of people in this room that were with me in my first 5 years of being clean. You want to just like raise your hand or stand up? All the people that we were here in my first 5 years clean before I moved to Alberta, like just stand up or wave your arm or something. Like just come on. Up, up, come on. Neil, Tim, Myler, everybody. Gino, all these people. Those are the people. Those people are why I'm here today. And I'm very grateful for that. I laughed when I read the swimming against the current. I'll talk about that in a second. And it also said my topic tonight is what is it? Miracles that happen in recovery. When I saw that, I said, you know, every single person in this room that's clean today is a miracle. That's the way it is, right? So kudos to all of us because we're all miracles. But also this topic, I laughed when Neil just, I said, what's the name of this convention anyway? He says, swimming against the current. Well, let me tell you. My first meeting was January 3rd of 1986. I was stoned. I'd been calling NA since Christmas Day of 1985. I called the hotline and a woman named Peggy answered. She's not around anymore, but she was here then. On Christmas Day, she talked to me for 2 hours, and I had gotten the phone number. I had the sugar daddy, and he had given me her phone number, and all he said to me is, there's this woman I've been talking to, and she's just like you, except that she doesn't do drugs or drink. And I'm like, yeah, well, I hope you all are having a good time. You know, but he left her number on my coffee table, and on Christmas Eve of that year, I was living on 8th Avenue and 103rd Street. Or 108th Street and 103rd Avenue in a place called the El Mirador. And that's where I lived when I got clean. And I had this guy, because I was right downtown, I had a little cookhouse and I was dealing and doing a bunch of things. But this guy came over to my house at 3 o'clock in the morning to have something cooked up, you know. And he told me that he was going to take over my business or give me 2 lead feet and drop me in the river. And it was a really weird thing. I'd had a couple of things happen. A couple of people died around me from their addiction. But I remember looking at this guy's eyes, and he had curly hair, you know, a little tuft here and a little tuft here, like two little devil horns. And I just saw the devil in his eyes, and I thought, this guy is possessed. And like, if I don't do something now, I'm really going to hell in a handbasket. So I ended up picking up the phone on Christmas Day. Anyway, I did say I'm charm, I'm an addict, right? Anyway, so January 3rd, and so I was calling Peggy every single day from Christmas Day until January 3rd. And every time I talked to her, like, my sugar daddy would phone her up and bitch about me, and I'd phone her and bitch about him. And she just kept trying to get me to go to a meeting, and I didn't know what she was talking about, right? Because I didn't know that she was, like, a member of Narcotics Anonymous. I just knew I was talking to this woman on the phone that didn't do drugs. And so we were talking, and she was just saying, you should go to a meeting. And finally she figured out that I probably wasn't going to do it by myself. So she came to my house on January 3rd and took me to my first meeting, which was that Friday night on White Avenue in the basement of the church. I forget what that meeting was called. But Neil was there, Joe was there, Gary Trudeau was probably there. I don't know who all was at that meeting. But anyway, there are some people in this room tonight that were at that meeting. Maureen was there that night. I remember that. Anyway, whatever. I went to that meeting, and because of this topic, I just want to mention it because the topic is swimming against the current. Well, I didn't know really what it was, this NA. And the first speaker was a guy named Bill W. who lives in Vancouver. We give each other our cake every year now. But Bill W. was the speaker to the newcomer. That's something I always loved about the meetings in Edmonton, as the speaker to the newcomer. And he was the first speaker. And I remember just kind of looking at him. And, of course, the old-timers at that time had 14 months clean. I think Rob had that. And there was just a couple of guys. And, you know, I think Neil had a year clean, or it was just over a year clean, whatever. And I think Shirley had a week clean, you know, whatever. We were quite a crew. Anyway, there was one meeting a day every day except Sunday. We had two, and there wasn't one on Wednesday. So we did have seven meetings, but there was no meeting on Wednesday. That opened after I got here. But anyway, I went to that meeting, and Bill talked. He did the speakers, the newcomer, and I identified immediately, and I'm so grateful. To this day, I'm so grateful that the first person I heard talk in Narcotics Anonymous I could identify with. And then all throughout the meeting, what happened to me just before I came into the meeting was my life really took a dive when I was like in my late 20s or whatever. And, you know, I just got into some heavy drugs. I'd been out of it, you know, in and out of it over the years, but I got into some heavy drugs. And in that winter, just before I came into recovery, I thought, well, I'll just go to school. That'll make my life better, you know. And so I was going to AGT or whatever that place. It was just down the block from my house, that college or whatever it was. I can't remember what it was called. But anyway, I was going to do some upgrading or something because I only had a graded education, which I'll talk about in a minute. But what was I saying? What was I going to talk about there? Anyway. Yeah, I was going to school at AGT. I was living on 8th Avenue there. And I started going to meetings right away, but I was stoned every day when I went to meetings. I went to meetings for 5 days, loaded. Saturday was Big Dougie was at the Cromdale. I was afraid to go in the Cromdale, but I went to the Cromdale and Dougie spoke and I cried for the whole meeting. You know, you walk into a meeting, there's this big biker, you know, with his leathers on, and he talks, and I cried for the whole meeting. I don't even know what he said. Oh, I remember what I was going to say was the speak at that Friday night meeting. What happened? So what happened was Bill spoke, and then other people were speaking, and I was doing school, and I was trying to get my shit together. And I thought, okay, I'll just use on weekends, and then my life will be better, and I'll go to school, and I'll get an education, get a job, and life will be good. But what happened was I was trying to control my using so that I could do the school thing, but that didn't work, you know. I was like, oh, I'll just smoke weed during the week and I'll party on the weekend and then I'll get through school and it'll all be good. But what happened was my back got really messed up. I was in a lot of pain. I was depressed. I was miserable. Like, things just spiraled even faster when I was trying to control my using. It was very weird. I didn't understand it. So what did I do in the meeting? I'm like, excuse me. I just want to know how come, because I'm only using on weekends, how come my life is getting worse? You know, like, can you please explain to me, like, what it is, what's going on? Like, I don't really understand it, you know. All through the meeting, I butted in the meeting, and I swear to God, it was a God shot that nobody told me, no crosstalk, don't talk in this meeting. Nobody said anything. I think they all just looked at me. After the meeting, Maureen actually came up to me. All these people were gathering around. I must have been terrifying. Actually, I was looking at these seats and nobody in it. And I thought, listen, I'm really nowhere near as scary as I used to be. You can come closer. It's okay. But anyway, at that time, nobody would really get too close. You know, they'd be like, hi, nice to meet you kind of thing. Not too many people wanted to hug me. Maureen came up. She came up. There was a bunch of people standing there. And she came up and stuck her hand between two people. She was behind two people. And she stuck her hand out and gave me her phone number. And I remember looking at the phone number thinking, what the hell does she want? You know what I mean? Like, I didn't really know what she wanted. But anyway, so I just butted in all through the meeting. So that's why I laughed when I read this, you know. Swimming against the current, yes. I wasn't doing the normal meeting format. I just butted in through the whole meeting. I was a very unruly character when I came here. Every second word was four letters. Most generally started with an F. I screamed a lot. I yelled at people in meetings if I didn't like what they were saying. There was one guy, I can't remember his name, Brian or something, I don't remember. One time he wanted to go back using with some friend who won the lotto and was going to Cuba or something, and he came to an NA meeting and he was like screaming at us and telling us how we're all horrible and blah, 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 and everybody was kid-gloving the guy. And towards the end of the meeting, I think that old, what was her name, Eileen or whatever her name was, she was like 70-year-old woman in the program, and pill popper, and she was chairing the meeting, and everybody was trying to kid glove this guy, and I'm like, pick me, pick me, pick me. And then finally, she had to pick me because my hand would not go down. And I just said, listen here, buddy. If you want to go somewhere and party and get stoned, don't be saying shit about this program because that's what you want to do, because this program is saving my life. Like, you go do what you want to do, but don't be talking shit about NA, right? But that's the way I was when I came in here. I'm a little bit better now. I don't generally scream at people much. I do say four-letter words now and then, but I try to keep it down to a dull roar. I mean, working at the university really helped with that, because when you're, like, sitting there with a bunch of professors, you can't just say every second word, you know what? You know, you kind of have to be a little more diplomatic and don't yell, you know? Anyway, so that's just kind of that's the beginning, right? That's the beginning. I went to meetings for 5 days, and on Wednesday, I woke up in the morning, and this voice said, today is the first day of the rest of your life. And I ran into the bathroom, and I looked in the mirror, and I'm like, what? Who said that? Where did that come from? I don't know where it came from. But I didn't get loaded that day, and I've never been loaded since January 8th, 1986. You know? I mean, it's so... The addict in me just kind of goes, what? How did that happen? You know? And just to give you a little bit of the backstory, I came here, I had, as Denise said, you know, I had a grade 8 education when I came to NA. I grew up in an alcoholic home, in an extremely violent home with a lot of... physical abuse, sexual abuse, verbal abuse, emotional abuse, mental abuse, like you name it, we had it all through my childhood. And I started running away when I was 4. First time I ran away, I was 4, made it to the Dairy Queen. By the time I was 13, I successfully escaped and I went to Vancouver, lived on the streets there for a while, and life went from bad to really it was hell. It was really horrible. You know, I ended up, some guy tried to take me to the U.S. and, you know, put me into the sex trade. It didn't happen, but he tried. Somebody actually saved me. That was weird, like some stranger saved me. And, you know, I had one guy one time when I was loaded and I was hitchhiking, you know, gets me in his truck, tries to rape me, sticks a knife at my throat, does this thing, and then throws me out on the gravel as he drives away, you know. Like, I had a lot of nasty shit happen, you know, after I hit the streets of Vancouver. And, yeah, I didn't know what to do. I was 13 years old living in Vancouver, and guess what? I got a job at a biker bar as a go-go dancer. That was my first job at 13 because they didn't have a liquor license, and I didn't need to be 18 to be in there. So that was my first gig. And I did that for 15 years. And then, then I had to quit because my high heels were killing my back. And the doctor said, if you don't quit dancing, you're never going to be able to walk again after about another year from now. And then that's kind of when things spiraled. I had this crazy... boyfriend doing, I don't know what kind of crime he was doing. I had to give up dancing. I didn't have any kind of career for myself. I didn't have anything going on in my life. And my addiction just spiraled. And I had periods like when I came back from the States, when I got away from that pimp, when I came back to Canada, I really was on a death spiral. Like, I really got into some heavy duty drugs for a while, and then I got off it for about 10 years. And I thought, okay, you know, I'm going to be okay. You know, I thought I was going to be okay. But then when I was 27 and I lost my dancing career, and this guy was cheating on me and went to jail and all this other crap happened, my life just went right down the toilet again. I got into hard drugs. And, you know, I mean, as crazy as it sounds, I'm grateful for my sugar daddy, because he's the one that showed me the door to you. You know, he's the one that helped me find NA. And I'm very, very grateful for that. And so anyway, I came here with grade 8 and I did detox, you know, in that time. For those of you that don't know, and I will talk a little bit of history, thank you very much. At that time, NA was a steering committee. It wasn't an area. And people would throw chairs, you know, at the steering committee meeting. And a couple of good things happened. You know, I went to meetings for, like, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and then Wednesday I didn't get loaded. And then Thursday I went to the detox meeting. I didn't want to go in the building because somebody said it was a government building, and I didn't know what a detox was. I had no clue. I didn't know anybody ever that got clean before I got here. I only ever saw one person in Vancouver that I knew had stopped using drugs, and they were walking down Granville Street, and they looked so depressed. I never would have thought of that as an option. Oh, you should just stop using. Life will be great. Never occurred to me, because I'd never seen anybody get straight and get happy. So that thought never entered my mind. But anyway, I went to that meeting. And I didn't want to go in because I thought, if I go in that building and they find out I'm in there, they're going to lock me up and throw away the key. So I didn't want to go in there. But then I didn't know what to do with myself. We're standing in the parking lot. This is on 3rd Avenue. We're standing in the parking lot, and I'm shuffling my feet. And finally, I followed somebody in there. And weirdly, I ended up, that was my first home group. And then, like, within a week, they made me the secretary. So, like, I had to show up and, you know, open the door and make the coffee. And I always say that was the key to my recovery. Was that key? Sorry, I'm going to try not to be emotional. There's a lot of stuff going on in my life actually right now, so it's a very emotional time. But anyway, they gave me that key. And now, I don't want anybody to be offended by what I'm going to say next, but I'm just going to tell you how it was for me, okay? Like, take it any way you want it, but this is how it was. So I got that key, and I had to show up every week, and I did see other people who had the key, or maybe they were the treasurer, or they were the chairperson, or they were the this or the that, or the whatever committee chair, and they'd get loaded, and they'd have to resign and give back the key, and they couldn't make the coffee anymore. They couldn't clean the ashtrays. Well, maybe they could clean the ashtrays, but they couldn't really do anything else anymore because they just got loaded. And I remember thinking, that is not going to happen to me. I am never going to walk in the doors of Narcotics Anonymous with my tail between my legs and have to turn in the key. That is not going to happen. Now, you can say ego will not keep you clean. And in the long term, I would say, yeah, ego will not keep you clean. But let me tell you, when I had that key, it helped me keep me clean. It really did, because I was not going to grovel in here. Whatever. You know, and, you know, I wasn't one to kind of go with the current anyway. You know, I kind of just did things whatever way. So it's just the way I was. But I had that key. And then I think within a month or something, I became the steering committee secretary, and Basil was there, and Neil was there, and, you know, Irene was there, and Bruce was there, all these people, Neil, all these people that were around back then. And it was pretty wild. The area meetings, I don't know what they're like here now, but the area meetings were incredible. The area meetings, man, everybody in NA was at the area meeting every month. The place was packed, because everybody had a goddamn opinion, and they wanted us all to know it. So they were all there. But that was really awesome. I mean, when I went to Vancouver, and they had these, we had hour and a half area meetings here. And in Vancouver, they had 5-hour meetings, and barely anybody showed up, and they just go on and on and on. They drove me crazy. I'm like, how can these people started NA here way before we started NA in Edmonton, but they're so far behind, and we were so far ahead. But I mean, I figured a lot of it was the people we had in the committee, because we had Basil, he was a physician, we had Irene, she was a nurse. Like, we had all these people who actually were educated, people who came here, I guess, with a couple of skills in their pocket before they came here. So they were able to contribute to Narcotics Anonymous in pretty, pretty awesome ways, because Edmonton NA was way ahead of a lot of other fellowships early on. It was really interesting. And anyway, so I was doing that. And in my own life, like aside from, like I was doing service work right away, but in my own life, like I couldn't work. I was just such a basket case. I detoxed in the room. I was crazy as a bed bug. As I say, I sounded like a truck driver. I looked like a truck driver and I acted like a truck driver. You know, it's amazing that some guy wanted to sleep with me. You know what I mean? But I did meet a guy at my first meeting who started sleeping with me when I had 3 days clean, like a week later. David, he lives in Victoria now. But he had 8 months clean at the time. I had 3 days. And we slept together for 3 months. And I finally got a clue about the second half of step one where it says, you know, what does it say in step one again? It says, powerless over our addiction, our lives have become unmanageable. The first part I could kind of get. You know, I thought, okay, yeah, like I just can't do this using thing anymore. The second part, I didn't get it because I thought, you know, if you'd have been shot at and had knives at your throat and, you know, beaten all through your childhood, burned and all this horrible stuff, like if this all happened to you and you lived through it, don't tell me your life's unmanageable because you survived. You know, that was my thinking at the time. And my first clue that I might have been off track was after 3 months, I rolled over and I looked at David and I thought, I don't even like this guy. I've been sleeping with this guy for 3 months and I actually do not like him. I thought, oh God, maybe my life's just a little tiny bit unmanageable. Just a bit. So, David helped me get step one. Yeah. I mean, they don't recommend you get into relationships, but in my case, it helped me with my step one, is to help me to realize that maybe my life was just a little bit unmanageable. And why would I say that it was unmanageable? Because I was sleeping with a guy that I didn't even like. It's because I had a really bad habit of getting myself into corners I'd never get out of clean, and I'd be lucky to get out of alive. And he was a manifestation of that in my recovery. Like, how weird is that, right? So I'm grateful to David that he helped me with my step one. I wasn't grateful at the time, but I did become grateful as time goes by, and I came to understand that, you know. And anyway, I'm bumbling along, you know. I still have my book, my first book that I got when I got clean. I got clean in January, so April I did my first step four. So that was interesting. That's another story. So there might have been somebody here who was around when that happened, when I did my first step four and five. But anyway, step two, I didn't get it at all. I just kind of, when I first looked at the steps, I just kind of read them. I went, yeah, sure, okay. I thought I'd done them, you know. But then I had to start to figure out what the hell they were talking about. And step two came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Well, I did not think I was insane. I thought everybody else was. It was all the people around me. They were nuts. There was nothing wrong with me. They were just cuckoo. And I thought even if I am insane, okay, coming to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity was just a joke as far as I was concerned. First of all, there's no wood. There's no might. There's no, it's a possibility. Could restore me to sanity. How is that possible? Because I just thought, I'm just a bag of bones and skin. When I walked in here, I weighed like 108 pounds. I won't tell you how much I weigh now, but I really was skin and bones. Anybody that knew me then can tell you. I was very, very thin. And I thought, you know, if you're gonna build something, you know, if you're gonna build a house, you need wood. You need cement. You need gravel. You need, I don't know what you need, but you need all kinds of stuff. And I thought there was no stuff here to work with. All there was a bag of bones. And so the couldn't be, because you know, if you want to make Gumby and Pokey, you need putty. There was no putty, you know. So I didn't get step two for a very long time. I just went right past it. And then step three, I just did it on pure blind faith. I didn't do it because I like God. I said if God came down in front of me when I was in that early recovery, I said if God stood in front of me, I would have punched him in the nose. Like why? Why does all this bad stuff happen to people? Why did this stuff happen to me when I was a little kid? Why does it happen to, like, all the stuff that I see? And I was a lot of stuff when I was 15. I read a book called Mila 18 by Leon Uris. And I read about the Second World War, and it really messed up my mind, like Poland and the Second World War. And I was even, it was like I related to the book really well because I felt like I'd lived in a prison or a cage as a child because that was the level of abuse that I experienced. And I really related in that book, but I thought, man, what's going on? Like, it's so much horrible stuff. And I just thought, if there was a God, then where were you? What God? Where? why is this stuff happening? And I couldn't relate to any of that, let alone that, you know, anything could be made out of me. I really didn't think I had any future. And so whatever, I just said, yeah, okay, fine. And then step three, I just kind of did it. I just kind of like on pure blind faith, I'm like, yeah, okay, yeah. I think I just turned my life over to NA. I didn't really turn my life over to God. I kind of just turned my life over to NA. You know, you were kind of like the fellowship or the program was my higher power, I guess, in the beginning. And I was just sort of bumbling along. I remember being at John's place one time, you know, John and Rita. I was at John's house one time with the step three, you know. God, I was jumping up and down. I was staying at his house. I don't know why. It was when they had that tornado here, you know, and whatever year that was. I can't remember. There was a Black Friday. They had this big tornado, and I was staying at John's house, and I remember I was in my room, and I was like a little five-year-old. I was jumping up and down in my bed. If you're there, fine, but I just don't get it. And I was just like screaming at God, jumping up and down on the bed, screaming, because I just didn't really get it. And I'm like, if you're there, then you're going to have to bloody well show me, because I don't see it. But I didn't look at the fact that, you know, I'd been clean for a year or two, for starters. I wasn't dead, you know, for starters. But anyway, so whatever. I just go, okay, maybe there's a God, but maybe I just don't know much about it. Neil always used to say, God is I don't understand him. And I went with that for a very long time. God is I don't understand him. And that was my best step three. And then I did my step four. My first step four, I said it was an immoral inventory. Every rotten thing everybody ever did to me and every rotten thing I did to everybody else. And then I went down to the Atlanta Club and I found this list of priests and I found one that didn't even have a church. And I said, that's the guy I'm going to do my step five with. Because I knew I'd never bump into him anywhere, you know. He lived out in Castle Downs and I went out to his house. In fact, a bunch of addicts got in a car, drove me up there to do my step five, and drove around the block while I was in there doing my step five, and then when I came out, they took me home. So I get up there, and the guy, it was a Sunday, or I think it was a Sunday, and the guy, so just as I went to knock on the door opened, and his wife came out with a basket, and the kids, you know, and they're kind of like prancing out the door like this, and I'm like, oh no. I think he forgot. And then he looked at his wife and he said, oh, honey, sorry, I forgot. I got this appointment. So you go ahead, I'll catch up to you later. I'm like, okay, here we go. Anyway, I went in his house. He had these beautiful, you know, Castle Downs, everything's so beautiful over there. He had this beautiful house. He had this beautiful white carpet in the living room with a beautiful white couch with a beautiful plastic on top of the couch. And, you know, everything was just beautiful and perfect. And, you know, you don't want to muss it up. So I sat on the floor. And he looked at me and I had a pile of, you know, all the immoral bad things I did and everything else, everybody else, like pile like this. And he looks at me and he goes, you know, he says, if everybody came here, everybody that came here read every page of what they wrote, he said, I would have no time for my own life. So he says, just tell me about what's the first thing you remember. So there I am talking about all this stuff that happened when I'm a kid and I'm, you know, pounding on, this and that, blah, 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 you know, whatever. Ranting about whatever happened to me, and we got up to I was about age 15 or something, and then he says, I paused for a moment, and he says, are you done? And I looked at him, I said, yeah. So he takes me in the dining room. He's got the beautiful big dining room table, nothing on it, you know, and he goes in his closet and he whips out, opens the closet and he whips out this cross and he throws it down on the table and he goes, look, he says, I want you to know that you're already forgiven, that God forgives you. But he says, I want you to ask for forgiveness anyway. I'm like, yeah, okay. Okay, God, forgive me for being a bitch. You know, and I'm sorry I took two lives. And just help me be a better person, okay? That was it. And then he sprinkled some holy water on me and shooed me out the door. And the addicts picked me up and took me home. And I got home, and I was looking at step six, entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. I'm like, okay, what are defects of character? I have no idea what we were talking about. But it said entirely ready. And I just said in my head, I said, I'm ready, I'm ready. And then step seven, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. And I said, okay, now I really, what the hell is that? What are we talking about now? I didn't know what we were talking about. But it said the word humbly. That was the clue. So I got down on my knees, and I said, okay, God, please remove my shortcomings. I had no idea what I was asking, but I did it. And then I laid down on my little futon. Bill has a funny story about that apartment. Bill Wong, he lives in Vancouver, my friend. I laid down on the couch, on the sofa, and I thought I went to sleep, but then I had this spiritual experience. I had a vision. Now I know it was a vision. At the time, I thought, God, was it? What, did I do too much acid? Like, that was just too weird. Because I had this, like, vision where God, Jesus came down, and he reached into my heart, and he pulled out this, my heart. He pulled it out, and I thought he was going to squish it and kill me, and he was just kind of smiling. And then something happened. I don't know. The door rang or something. I don't know. And he, poof, that disappeared. And then I thought about it for the longest time. I thought, man, I really did do too many drugs. It really messed up my brain, you know. But then the more and more as time went by, I thought about it and thought about it and thought about it because it was just such a weird vision. And I finally came to the conclusion that my God knew that I knew that God was there. And not only that, but God took my cold heart and made it warm, you know, turned that rock into a heart, you know. So it was kind of a big day in my recovery, you could say, kind of one of those spiritual moments. Anyway, so that was my step seven. I think I could go on more about the steps, but I won't do that more because I have a couple other things I want to talk about. But I wanted to talk a little bit about the history of Narcotics Anonymous and just a real short, like what happened. So when I got clean, I wasn't employable. And of course, I didn't have a job history. You'd put on a resume if you wanted a job, you know. Oh, yes, stripper, drug dealer, you know, crack cooker, you know. Where am I going to get a job? I don't know. But anyway, I did start getting a job after a year. I think my first job was at the Bissell Center. And then I got the job in the jewelry store where I ended up being the manager, and they gave me the key, which I could just never believe they gave me the key, but it's only because they don't know who I am. And then I did get hooked up with a guy here for a little while, and he relapsed, and then I moved away to Vancouver. And I bumbled around there for a while, and I had a lot of shame. I had a lot of depression in my early recovery, a lot of PTSD symptoms. I had to do a lot of therapy because I really did have a lot of trauma both before and after I left home. And, you know, I really encourage people just go get the help. Like, you know, put your pride aside and just do it, you know. But so I was bumbling around Vancouver, and I remember, like, I left here. I was 5 years clean, 1991. And I got to Vancouver, and I didn't want to take my six-year K because I just felt like such a zero. Here I am, 6 years clean, I'm zero. What have I got to show for myself? Nothing. No guy, no kids, no job, no car, nothing. I had a roof over my head, that was about it. And I had a service resume. I've been doing lots of service. Speaking of which, I actually chaired the third convention of Edmonton area. We had that was when Jim Bernstein spoke here. That was a lot of fun. But anyway, and I also I was the first secretary treasurer of the Alsace region. That was a lot of fun. We traveled all over the province, and we had an outreach committee. We'd go to all these tiny little towns and visit people. We had this one guy from, I think it was from, where was he? It was White Court. We had this one guy that used to come from White Court. He started an NA meeting there, and Joe and me, a bunch of us, used to get in a car and go up to a White Court. And when we first went there for the first year, he would just sit there and read his NA book, and his wife would make the coffee because she was a good Narnon. And we just, like, have our little meeting when we were there. And after a year and a half, we went to the meeting, and there was 16 people there when we got there. It was just so incredible. Al, his name was, he was a really good guy. He used to come to, he was part of our area because the area, we had two areas in Alberta at that time. There was the northern, which included mainly Edmonton, and then I guess Calgary and everything south of Edmonton, I suppose, something like that. I can't remember exactly, but so we started the Alsace region. That was really fantastic. And then when I went to Vancouver, of course, I did a lot of service there as well. And that was the one thing. I mean, it really, all through my recovery, I have to say that doing service was just a total godsend. I always say, you know, the best things about my recovery, like what makes my recovery great, is that you're in it and that I chose to do service. And I've done a lot of service over the years. And anyway, I went there, and I was battling severe depression for like a lot of years. I was very suicidal for a few years after I got clean, and I had to do a lot of therapy before I ever got past it. I remember talking to Neil one day, and I said, well, I says, you know, I haven't thought about killing myself lately. And he said, wow, that's great. That's progress. And I remember looking at him thinking, what? You're retarded, you know? Like, I'm crazy. Don't you know I'm crazy? You know, like I'm telling you, anyway. Later I came to realize he was true. It was true, you know. Obviously, when I stopped wanting to kill myself, that was another big day. I didn't know it at the time, but turned out it was a big day in my recovery, the day I didn't want to kill myself anymore. And when I was like 9 or 10 years clean, something like that, I don't know, I decided to go to school. And somehow or another, I got in as a mature student. I just applied. I applied to the college. I wrote some exam, and they just let me in. I didn't even have my grade 12. After they let me in, I went and did my GED. I just went and got a book, read the book, did the test, and I only failed the math. So I did the math chapter, and then I did another pretest, and I passed it, and I went and wrote the exam and passed it and just went into college. And I actually didn't spend 10 years in school. I spent 15 years in school. Almost another couple of years, it'll be one-third of my recovery. That I spent in school, and in another couple of years, let's see how many, 1836, oh, I guess I got to go to a ways to go before I hit three times as long as I used, but whatever, anyway, so I went to school, and, you know, I don't know about you, or I don't know, you know, when I came here, like I say, I just felt like such a big fat zero, and I felt like that for a really long, 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 long time, and I was glad when I stopped wanting to kill myself, even though I really didn't know what the hell I was doing here, or why I was here, or whatever, but anyway, I did go back to school. And I started doing the school thing. I didn't know how it was going to work. First, I did real estate, and then I didn't stick with it because it was in the 90s, and real estate was horrible at that time. I mean, it was just a nasty world and not much going on. I didn't stay in it. And I was actually staying. When I used to strip, there was a guy that owned a hotel in Vancouver, was a friend of mine, who weirdly got clean 3 months after I left Vancouver. He got clean in Vancouver, like after I left Vancouver, he got clean. He kicked me out of Vancouver. He says, get out of town, get out of here. Gave me a handful of money and told me, get lost and don't come back here, and, you know, otherwise he'd probably kill me or something like that. But then I left town, and then he got clean 3 months later. And when I went back, he gave me a hotel room. He owned a hotel that I used to dance in. He gave me a hotel room. He says, okay, you know, just go do. He said, what do you really want to do? I said, I want to do real estate, because I thought, I'll do real estate, I'll get rich, and I'll be happy. You know, we always want to be happy, right? That's all we ever want. And so I lived in this hotel for about a year and a half, and I did the course and online, 97th percentile, I graduated, and then I did the real estate for a year, sold a couple of places, but I didn't want to stay there for another year, you know, the tradition 7, you know, became entirely self-supporting, declining outside contributions. After a year, I just couldn't live off him for another year. So I left, and I decided, okay, I'll go. And he always laughed. He says, well, maybe the reason you did the real estate is because you're supposed to go back to school. And I'd look at him like, yeah, ain't gonna happen, right? A year before that, before I went back to school, I was jumping up and down saying, I can't do it, I'm too old, I can't have all those student loans. I mean, I'll be paying for the rest of my life. I'm not gonna have no life at all, ever. We're such drama queens, you know. Anyway, a year later I went back to school, and I spent 7 years going to university. I did a bachelor's and a master's, and then I went to work in the downtown east side where addiction was like so glaringly horrible. And then the university hired me to work in the social work department and develop an indigenous social work program and teach social work classes. So I did that for 9 years. And then I had to leave the downtown east side because they wanted me full time, so I had to give that job up. And then while I was at the university, while I was working there, I decided, I guess if I'm going to stay here, I have to go do a PhD. So I did. I went to Simon Fraser and I did a PhD. Doctor of Philosophy degree in education, which was really interesting because I don't know about you, but my whole time when I was in school, I thought they only gave me those keys to that jewelry shop because they don't know who I am. They don't know what a low bottom shit ass addict I am, you know? And when I got to school, they only let me in there because they don't know who I am. And then when they graduate, they sent me a letter saying I was on the dean's list. So I thought I was in trouble. I didn't know they had to be in the top 10 academically to be on the dean's list. I thought I was in trouble. And then they invited me to my graduation. I'm like, why am I on the dean's list? I'm obviously in trouble, but they're inviting me to the graduation. Like, I was crazy. Like, what is going on here? But they did. That's what happened. And then, you know, I went to university. I ended up on the Golden Key National Honor Society because I was the top 50% of students at UBC. You know, wow, you know, like all this stuff. But all the time I was there, it wasn't until I was doing the master's program, I was walking down the hall of the School of Social Work one day, thinking that same thought again. They only let you in here because they don't know who you are. And then I stopped and I went, wait a minute. I've been in the social work department here for 4 years now, going to school. They know who you are because I've been writing about who I am and what I'm about. You know, you got to write papers, you got to write stuff, right? And you usually write based about your own experience and as it relates to whatever book you read. So they know who I am. And I was like, oh, shit, they do know who I am, you know. So I had to let that go, that idea. But then when I went to Simon Fraser, it was the same thing. I used to drive up that mountain, up Burnaby Mountain, every week to my class. And I thought, I don't belong up there. I'm not one of them. Like, I'm just not one of them, you know. I always felt like an outsider. I always felt less than. And I went anyway. I just kept going anyway because I was not going to let them win. I was not going to fail. I was not going to quit. They weren't going to kick me out. And I mean, there was shit that happened there. I mean, I'm, as an Indigenous woman trying to do research in the PhD department at Simon Fraser, let me tell you, they gave me some grief. I don't know what that's about. We won't go there. But nonetheless, that happened. But, you know, I wasn't going to back down. You know, just like I wasn't going to back down with that key the first time I came in here. What was that line again? Submit, swimming against the current? I don't know. Anyway, I was not going to back down. And I remember the very day when I graduated with my PhD, and I don't know, anybody here who's gone to university, you know how this goes. They first the college kids, you know, the certificate and the diploma, and then the bachelor's, and then the master's, and then the PhD. And they all come up on the stage, and they walk over here, and they give them a handshake, and they walk over there, and they give them their piece of paper, give them another handshake, and off they go on the stage back to their seat with their parents. Bachelor students, same thing. You know, master's students, same thing. Well, when you get to the PhD, guess what? You walk up here, they give you your handshake, and then they give you your piece of paper, and you're not supposed to walk off the stage. You have to go stand with the rest of the PhDs. And I remember standing there with all those people, and my first thought was, I don't belong here. And my second thought was, you earned it. Hold your head up. Hold your head up. You know? So... You know, what's the message of that story? And it's one of the things I like to tell people that are new or old in Narcotics Anonymous. I don't really care what you think. Honestly, I don't care. And I don't really care what you feel. And it really doesn't matter. Because I never felt worthy of anything. You know, and I ended up with a PhD, running a private practice, teaching in the university, owning my own apartment, owning a cat. You know, that's what happened to me, in spite of the fact that I did not feel worthy, you know. I didn't feel that, whatever, I earned it or I deserved it or anything, you know, or I was worthy of it. I didn't feel any of those things. And even when I first came in Narcotics Anonymous, when I first got clean and I looked at all of you and some of you were happy and I would scratch my head wondering why you were happy. I didn't know what you were happy about because I was not happy. And I would look at you, and I learned, and Neil helped me a lot with this. Like, he used to have this line. He used to say things that would make me scratch my head. He'd say, my recovery, or he'd say, my happiness. No, he'd say, my recovery, my happiness is, I can't remember how it goes, but essentially what he was saying was that my recovery was not contingent upon me being happy. Don't matter if you're happy. We don't, you know, if you're having a bad day or a good day, just show up and tell us about it. Whatever, do whatever you got to do, but just keep coming back. And we don't care if you feel good or you feel bad. We're going to welcome you, and we're going to try and help you stay clean for another day. Because that's how it works in here. This is not about, yeah, yeah, okay, you got feelings you got to sort out. Yeah, yeah, okay, you might, you know, be like me and be telling yourself all kinds of garbage in your head that I told myself for a whole lot of years. But you know what? The best thing you can do is just say, thank you for your opinion. But I think I'm going to go to a meeting.
I think I'm going to get myself to the convention committee. You know, whatever it is. Like, don't worry about what's in your head or what's going on down here. Get to another meeting. Go talk to your sponsor. Go help a newcomer, whatever. Let them do their step five with you or whatever. That'll take you right out of yourself in about a minute. You know, just do that kind of stuff. You know? So, anyway, yeah, I won't go. I could go back and talk some more about the rest of the steps, but, you know, yeah, I don't probably even need 10 minutes. But yeah, I mean, you know what? I always tell people, you know, when I came here, it really is an inside job. It's all these things I've just told you about what I did since I came into recovery. You know, it really doesn't matter. What matters is that if I wasn't here in Narcotics Anonymous, none of that shit would have happened. None of that stuff that I have would have had, I would have. I wouldn't have the friends I have. I wouldn't have the life I have. I wouldn't have any of that stuff if I didn't just keep showing up in NA. And the same reason I have a PhD is because you told me, you said, even if your ass has fallen off, get out there to that meeting. And mine was, even if your ass has fallen off, go to class. Even if your ass has fallen off, write that damn paper. Even if you feel like this is stupid and it's hopeless and you're never going to get anywhere and you're never going to be anybody, read that damn book and show up in your classroom. Get to that damn committee meeting, whatever it is. Go to that H&I meeting out of the jails. I used to go out to the Ford and I used to go out to Edmonton Max. I thought I was crazy. Like, I look back and I think I was insane. Like, I would go to the Edmonton Max to the lifers, you know, or the guys that were waiting to death row, and I'd say, well, you know, the difference between me and you is when this meeting's over, I get to go home. Now, you're dealing with some very violent people. And this is what you tell them? Probably wasn't really bright. Thank God there was some guards around, you know. It's probably the only reason I got out of there alive, I imagine. I don't know. But, you know, I mean, it doesn't really matter. And the other thing I'll say, too, so it doesn't matter really, you know, I'm not saying that it's irrelevant. What you think and what you feel is all real in your own mind. It's all real in your own heart, in your own body. It's all real. But that doesn't have to be, you know, just because I felt like jumping off the bridge doesn't mean I got to do it. Or just because, you know, I had the thought of doing it, it doesn't mean I should do it. So when I learned to start sort of listening to my thoughts and noticing my feelings and doing the next right thing anyway that you taught me to do, guess what? I end up with a PhD. Guess what? I end up with a cat that I can actually keep. You know, I end up with a car and I actually pay the insurance. And when somebody bumps the bumper, you know, it's going to be paid for. You know what I mean? All these like silly little things that happen, you know, if I just do the next right thing. So that's what I learned. Just do the next right thing. Just go to another meeting. Don't forget to talk to your sponsor. Don't forget to talk to a newcomer. Don't forget to go to a meeting. Don't forget to share your truth, you know. Just don't forget to do the same things that I learned when I got here in Narcotics Anonymous, because anything that I just said to you is only a result of the fact that I learned to do those couple of things you told me to do when I first got here. And not only that, you tolerated me. When I was probably pretty intolerable. I mean, I wasn't violent, but I was a yeller, and I was a swearer. You know, I was, yeah. Bill always tells this story. He came to pick me up and take me to a meeting, and he arrived at my apartment, and he opened the door. I opened the door. I said, come on in. And I had, like, the futon I told you about earlier, over here. And over here was a old dresser with those big round mirrors, you know, the old vanity. And hanging above the vanity was a whip and some handcuffs and a few other little goodies. He would not come into my apartment. I don't know what his problem was, but he did not want to come in there. He stood in the hallway and waited for me. He said, I'll be out here when you're ready. Come on out. We'll go to the meeting. Okay. So we go off to a meeting, you know. Anyway, I hope that I've said something for somebody here that will help you in your recovery today, because that's the only reason that we do these things, like have confessions, is so that we can share our recovery, we can share the experience and strength and hope and the joy and the gratitude and the love that Narcotics Anonymous has to offer. And I can tell you that my life, because I'm in Narcotics Anonymous and because I have friends, like there's a whole table full of people there that I've known for my entire recovery, and everyone that's a member of Narcotics Anonymous that's in my life, my life is 10 times richer because they're in it. Without you, if I was just in NA and I didn't let you in at all, which took me a long time, most of them will tell you, I wasn't really good at really letting people in. But most of them will tell you that I wasn't good at that. But to the degree that I let them into my life is beautiful because of that. And for that, I will ever, ever be grateful. Thank you.